taciturnity with my own. And where'd you find the German? Dead paratrooper in Leningrad. I hope that was vague enough to leave open the possibility that I had killed the paratrooper. They're dropping into Leningrad? It started? Just a commando raid, I guess. Only a few got through. Didn't go so well for the Fritzes. I thought that sounded right, offhand, as if I was a sort of a killer who spoke casually of the enemies I'd dispatched. You killed them yourself? I opened my mouth, fully prepared to lie, but the way she looked at me, her lips curled into that smirk that both angered me with its condescension and made me want to kiss her. The cold killed him. I just saw him falling. She nodded and handed back the knife, stretching her arms behind her head and giving a tremendous yawn, not bothering to cover her mouth. Her teeth were like children's teeth, very small and not quite matching. She looked content, as if she'd just eaten a 9-course meal served with the best wines, though all I'd seen her nibble on was a black radish. The cold is Mother Russia's oldest weapon, I added, some line I'd heard a general spout on the radio. Immediately I wished I could retract it. Maybe it was true, but it had been a propaganda cliché for months now. Even mouthing the phrase Mother Russia made me feel like one of those stupid smiling young pioneers marching in the parks in their white shirts and red ties, singing The Little Joyful Drummer. I have a knife too, she said, slipping a birch-handled dagger out of a sheath tucked into her belt and offering it to me hilt first. I turned the slender blade in my hand. There was a pattern of fine lines on the steel, like ripples in disturbed water. Seems a little flimsy. It's not. She leaned forward to run the tip of her index finger along the textured blade. That's Damascus steel. She was close enough now that I could study the curling ridges of her ear or the creases that interrupted the smooth span of her forehead when she raised her eyebrows. A few stray pine needles were lodged in the thicket of her hair, and I resisted the impulse to pluck them out. It's called a puko, she told me. All the Finnish boys get them when they come of age. She took the knife back from me and tilted it so she could admire the play of firelight on metal. The best sniper in the world is a Finn. Simo Hauha, the White Death. 505 confirmed kills in the Winter War. So you took that off some Finn you shot? Bought it. For 80 rubles in teriyaki. She slipped the dagger back into the sheath on her belt and surveyed the room, looking for something more interesting to occupy her attention. Maybe you can be the Red Death, I said, trying to keep talking because I knew if I stopped, I would never regain the courage to start again. That was some fine sniping out there. I guess the Einsatz commandos aren't used to people shooting back at them. Vika regarded me with her cold blue eyes. There was something not entirely human about her gaze, something predatory, lupine. She made a circle of her lips before shaking her head. Why do you think those were Einsatz commandos? The girls told us that's who comes here. What are you, 15? You're not a soldier. 17. But you're traveling with a soldier, who's not with his unit. Well, as he was saying, we have special orders from Colonel Grechko. Special orders to do what? Organize the partisans? Do I look so very stupid to you? No. You came here to visit the girls, is that it? One of these is your girlfriend. I was strangely proud that she thought one of the lovely girls in the house might be my girlfriend, even though I could hear the insulting tone in her phrasing, one of these. She was curious about me. That was a start. And she was right to be curious. Why should a Peter boy be all the way out here, 20 kilometers behind enemy lines, resting in a comfort house maintained for officers of the invaders? I remembered what Kolya had told me about enticing a woman with mystery. We have our orders. I'm sure you have yours. Let's keep it at that. Vika stared at me in silence for a few seconds. She might have been enticed, but it was hard to tell. Those Germans out there with their brains in the snow, that's regular army. You'd think a boy, working with the NKVD would know the difference. I didn't get a chance to inspect their insignia because you people were pointing your rifles at us. We're looking for Einsatz, though. That's big game. We've been hunting this corpse fucker, Abendroth, the last 6 weeks. Thought he might be here tonight. I had never heard the curse corpse fucker before. The phrase sounded brutally vulgar, coming from her lips. I smiled for some reason, a smile that must have seemed odd and unprovoked. In my mind, I pictured her with her pants off. The image was sharp and detailed, far more convincing than my imagined nudes usually were. Maybe Kolya's pornographic playing cards really had helped. Abendroth's in a house in Novoyokoshkino, I told her, by the lake. The information seemed to entice her more than anything else I had said. My inappropriate smile, matched with my knowledge of the Nazis' whereabouts, made me momentarily intriguing. Who told you that? A more mysterious man would have known how to deflect the question, how to sidestep like a boxer, bobbing and weaving, never getting tagged. I knew something she wanted to know. For the first time, I had a slight advantage over her. The words Novoyokoshkino gave my NKVD credentials a touch of credence, offered me some leverage I could exploit. Lara, I said, giving it all away with a word. Which one is Lara? I pointed her out. As Vika's unblinking gaze shifted, I felt that I had somehow betrayed Lara. She had been generous, given us shelter from the cold, fed us warm food, ventured into the brutal winter night in her bare feet to help defend us from the suspicious partisans, and I had surrendered her name to this smirking blue-eyed killer. Vika slid her feet off the sofa, her toes in their wool socks grazing against my pants leg. She stood and walked over to Lara, who was crouched by the fire, adding another log to the blaze. With her boots off, I saw how small Vika really was, but she moved with a kind of lazy grace you see in athletes when they're relaxing away from the playing field. This is modern warfare, I thought, where muscle means nothing, and a slender girl can have a German's head at 400 meters. Lara seemed nervous when she saw the sniper smiling down at her. She rubbed the soot off her hands as she listened to Vika. I couldn't hear the conversation, but I saw Lara nod, and from the way she gestured with her hands, I figured she was giving Vika directions. Kolya walked into the room with Korsakov. Each had a glass of vodka in hand, and they were laughing at some joke, best of chums now, the earlier hostility forgotten. I had expected nothing less. Kolya was a great salesman, especially when he was selling himself. He ambled over to the horsehair sofa and sat down with a sigh, slapping my knee and downing the last of his vodka. "You get enough to eat?" he asked me. "We're ready to move. We're leaving. I thought we'd sleep here tonight." The gunfight had riled my system, but now that some time had passed since the bullets were flying, I felt the fatigue seeping back into my bones. We had walked all day through the snow, and I hadn't slept in Sonia's apartment. "Come on, you're smarter than that. What do you think is going to happen when those Fritzes out there don't come back from their little party tonight? How long before they send a platoon to find out where their Oberleutnants disappeared to?" Vika had gotten what she needed from Lara. Now she spoke in low tones to Korsakov, the two of them standing in the corner of the room, the broad-shouldered, stubble-jawed partisan commander and his little assassin, lit by the flickering fire. The other partisans began to get ready, pulling on their dry socks and their felt boots, swallowing one more glass of vodka for the long march ahead of them. The girls of the house had disappeared to the back rooms where I guess they would grab whatever they could carry and decide where to go next. "We could take the German cars," I said, inspired by the idea. "Drop off the girls and Peter." Like most ideas I considered inspired, the brilliance of it faded before I reached the end of the second sentence. "Drive a Kubel toward the Leningrad line," said Kolya. Yes, that's a thought. And when our own people blow us off the road and some Don Cossack country idiot pulls our smoking bodies from the wreckage, he'll say, "Huh, these German boys look just like us." No, little line. We're not going back to Peter yet. We've got business in Novaya Koshkino. Chapter 17. 20 minutes later, we were trudging through the snow again, the warmth of the farmhouse already slipping from memory. Flanked by mighty pines, we walked in single file, with 9 paces between each man on Korsakov's explicit orders. I didn't understand the tactical significance of the formation, but trusted that these men were masters of the ambush and knew what they were doing. Kolya walked in front of me, and with my head hanging low, I was aware only of the hem of his greatcoat and his black leather boots. The rest of the bodies in our little caravan were phantoms, unseen and unheard, except for the occasional crack of the stepped-on twig or the rasp of a canteen cap unscrewed for a sip of still-hot tea. I had never really believed that truism that soldiers learned how to sleep while they marched, but as we continued east, lulled by the rhythm of our boots rising and falling in the snow, I lurched in and out of wakefulness. Even the cold could not keep me alert. Novaya Kushkino was only a few kilometers from the farmhouse by road, but we were far from any road, circling around German encampments that Kolya and I would have stumbled into if we were unescorted. Korsakov had said the march would take 4 hours. Before the first one was over, I felt that someone had poured thick syrup into a hole in my skull. Everything I did slowly. If I wanted to rub my nose, I was aware of the brain's command and the hand's grudging obedience. The long journey the hand took on the way to the face, the search for the nose, usually an easy target, and the hand's grateful return to its cozy little cave in the depths of my father's navy coat. The more tired I got, the more doubtful the whole scenario seemed. How could this be real? We were a band of enchanted mice, marching beneath the chalked moon on the blackboard sky. A sorcerer lived in Novaya Vakushkino, a man who knew the ancient words that could transform us back into the men we once were. But there would be perils along the way, giant black cats scrambling over the ice, lunging for us as we scurried for cover, our long tails twitching with fear. My boots sank deep into a mound of soft snow, and I nearly turned my ankle. Kolya stopped and looked back when he heard me stagger, but I managed to right myself, give him a quick nod, and keep walking without any help. The girls who lived in the farmhouse had left at the same time we did. They did not have any overcoats or winter boots. The Germans had taken those items away after Zoya made her run. Without proper clothes, the girls resorted to layering, throwing on every shirt they had, every sweater and pair of leggings, until they teetered beneath the weight, wobbling through the great room like drunk, obese peasants. Galina had brought up the idea of taking the Nazis' overcoats, but she was quickly shushed. Their chances were bad enough if they were captured, but getting captured while wearing a dead officer's coat was the end. Kolya and I had kissed their cheeks at the doorway. They had decided not to go to Leningrad. A few of them had family there, but the uncles and cousins might have died already or fled to the east. More important, there was no food in Leningrad for the residents, and certainly no food for 4 girls from the villages with no ration cards. Leningrad did not make sense, so they were heading south. They had brought whatever provisions were left after the partisans took what they wanted. Korsakov let them keep 2 of the Germans' Lugers for protection. Their odds were not good, but they seemed in high spirits as they walked out the farmhouse door. They had been prisoners there for months, had suffered their own tortures night after night, and now they were free. I kissed all 8 cheeks, waved goodbye, and never saw them again or heard anything about them. Something jolted my shoulder, my eyes popped open, and I realized I had been walking in a semi-conscious trance. Kolya marched beside me now, his gloved hand gripping me through my coat. "You still with us?" he asked quietly, watching me with real concern. "I'm here." "I'll walk with you, keep you awake," Korsakov told us to. "I don't take orders from that motherless pig. You saw how he treated the girls. You're the one who was getting so chummy with him. We need him right now, and his little friend. I saw you staring at her back there by the fireplace. You'd like to take a shot at that sniper, eh? Eh? Ha!" I shook my head, too tired even to groan at his miserable joke. "Have you ever been with a redhead? Oh, wait, what am I saying? You've never been with anyone." "The good news is, they're demons between the sheets. 2 of the 3 best fucks of my life were redheads. 2 of 4, anyway. But the other side of the coin, they hate men. A lot of anger there, my friend. Beware." "All redheads hate men?" Makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Any redhead you meet out here, chances are she's descended from some Viking who ran around hacking people's arms off before raping her ancestral grandmother. She's got the blood of the pillagers in her.
That's a good theory. You should tell her about it. On every stride, I tried to step into the boot prints of the partisan who walked 18 strides ahead of us. Stepping into crushed snow took less energy than stepping into fresh powder, but the man in front had long legs, and I was having a hard time matching him. "And just so I'm clear," I began, panting a little and ducking beneath an outflung branch laden with pine needles. "We're marching to Novoye Koshkino to find the house where the Einsatzgruppe is headquartered, because they might have some eggs there?
That's what we're doing for the colonel, but for us and for Russia. We're marching to Novoye Koshkino to kill the Einsatz because they need to be killed."
I lowered my head so that most of my face was shielded from the wind by the upturned collar of my father's greatcoat. What was the point of further discussion? Kolya considered himself a bit of a bohemian, a free thinker, but in his own way he was as much a true believer as any young pioneer. The worst part about it was that I didn't think he was wrong. The Einsatz commandos needed to be destroyed before they destroyed us. I just didn't want to be the one responsible for destroying them. Was I supposed to sneak into their lair with only a knife for protection? 5 days ago, an account of this expedition would have seemed like the great adventure I'd been waiting for since the war began. But now, in the middle of it, I wished I'd left in September with my mother and sister.
"Do you remember the end of Book One of The Courtyard Hound? When Rachenko sees the old professor stumbling down the street, muttering at the pigeons?
Worst scene in the history of literature."
"Oh, forgive me. You've never read the book."
There was something oddly comforting in Kolya's consistency, his willingness to make the same jokes, if you could call them jokes, over and over again. He was like a cheerful, senile grandfather who sat at the dinner table with beet soup splattered on his collar, telling once more the story of his encounter with the emperor, though everyone in his family could recite it now from memory. "One of the most beautiful passages in literature, you know. His professor had been a famous writer back in his day, but now he's completely forgotten. Rachenko feels ashamed for the old man. He watches him through the bedroom window. Rachenko never leaves his apartment. Remember, he hasn't left in 7 years. He watches the professor walk out of sight, kicking at the pigeons and cursing them."
Kolya cleared his throat and switched to his declamatory tone. "Talent must be a fanatical mistress. She's beautiful. When you're with her, people watch you. They notice. But she bangs on your door at odd hours, and she disappears for long stretches, and she has no patience for the rest of your existence, your wife, your children, your friends. She is the most thrilling evening of your week, but some days she will leave you for good. One night, after she's been gone for years, you will see her on the arm of a younger man, and she will pretend not to recognize you." Kolya's apparent immunity to exhaustion aggravated and amazed me. I could keep moving only by sighting a distant tree and promising myself that I would not quit before I reached it, and when we got to that tree, I would find another and swear this was the last one. But Kolya seemed capable of traipsing through the woods, orating with a stage whisper, for hours at a time. I waited a moment to make sure he was finished before I nodded. "That's nice."
"Isn't it?"
he said quickly, pleased to hear it. The way he responded made me study his moonlit face. "You've got most of the book memorized?"
"Oh, I don't know about that. Passages here and there."
The snow was deeper as we crossed a ridge, making each step more of a chore, and I huffed and wheezed like an old man with one lung as I staggered toward the next tree.
"Can I ask you something?"
"You just did," he said, with his annoyingly pleased smile.
"What do you write when you write in your journal?"
"Depends on the day. Sometimes just notes on what I've seen. Sometimes I hear someone say something, a line or two, and I like the way it sounds." I nodded and experimented by keeping one eye closed for 10 seconds, then the other, alternating in a bid to give them some rest and spare them from the wind.
"Why do you ask?"
"I think you're writing The Courtyard Hound."
"You think... You mean a critique of The Courtyard Hound?"
"Well, I am. I told you that. Someday I'll give lectures on the book. Maybe 7 men in Russia know more about Ushakovo than I do. I don't think there is an Ushakovo. I pushed up my cap so I could get a better look at him. You keep telling me it's this classic, and I've never heard of it. And you were very happy when I told you I liked that bit. You were proud of it. If I quoted Pushkin for you, and you said the writing was good, it wouldn't make me proud, would it? They're not my lines. Kolya's expression never changed. His face admitted nothing, denied nothing. But you did like it. It's not bad. You just came up with that? Over the last few hours. You know what inspired me? That poem of your father's. An old poet, once famous, seen at a cafe? That was another clue. You robbed him blind. He laughed, blowing a great gust of vapor into the frigid air. This is literature. We don't call it robbery, we call it homage. What about the first line of the book? You like that too? I don't remember the first line of the book. In the slaughterhouse where we first kissed, the air still stank from the blood of the lambs. A little melodramatic, isn't it? What's wrong with drama? All these contemporary writers are such timid little fish. Melodrama, I said. But if the subject demands intensity, it should get intensity. So this whole time, why didn't you just tell me you were writing a novel? Kolya stared at the moon, sinking now toward the fringe of the pine tops. Soon it would be down, and we'd be walking in true darkness, tripping over roots and slipping on patches of black ice. The truth is, the first night I met you, in the crosses, I thought they were going to shoot us in the morning, so what did it matter what I told you? I said whatever popped into my head. You told me they weren't going to shoot us. Well, you seemed a little frightened. But come on, think about it. A deserter and a looter? What were our chances? The next tree I had chosen as a way station seemed impossibly far away. A silhouetted pine that loomed above its brothers, a silent sentinel, older than all the rest. While I panted, Kolya sipped tea from his canteen, a naturalist out for an evening hike. Army rations greatly exceeded civilian rations. That was my rationale for his superior energy, ignoring the fact that we had eaten the same meals for the last several days. You said you left your unit so you could defend your thesis on Ushakovo's The Courtyard Hound, I said, pausing between each sentence to regain my breath. And now you're admitting there is no Ushakovo and there is no Courtyard Hound.
But there will be, if I live long enough.
Why did you leave your unit?
It's complicated.
You two about to fuck in the bushes? Kolya and I wheeled around. Vika had crept up behind us without a sound, close enough so that I could have reached out and touched her cheek. She glared into our faces with contempt, obviously disgusted to be in the company of such miserable soldiers. You were told to march in single file with a 9-stride gap. Her voice was very low for such a small girl. Hoarse, as if she had been sick the week before and her larynx hadn't recovered yet. She was a practiced whisperer, able to enunciate each quiet word so that we could understand everything, yet anyone standing 5 meters away would not hear a thing. You're strolling along like a couple of faggots, chatting about books. You realize we've got German camps within 2 kilometers of where we stand. You want to end up in a ditch with all the communists and Jews? That's your business, but I plan on seeing Berlin next year.
He's a Jew, said Kolya, jabbing at me with his thumb, ignoring the angry look I directed his way.
Are you? Well, you're the first dumb Jew I ever met. Either turn around and go back to Peter, or else shut your mouths and follow our rules. There's a reason we haven't lost a man in 2 months. Now go on. Move. With a hand on each of our backs, she shoved us forward, and we resumed our places in the single file, 9 strides between us, shamed into silence. I thought about the non-existent author Ushakovo and his non-existent masterpiece, The Courtyard Hound. For some reason, I wasn't angry at Kolya. It was a strange lie, but a harmless one, and the farther I walked, the more I understood his motivation. Kolya seemed fearless, but everyone has fear in them somewhere. Fear is part of our inheritance. Aren't we descended from timid little shrews who cowered in the shadows while the great beasts stomped past? Cannibals and Nazis didn't make Kolya nervous, but the threat of embarrassment did. The possibility that a stranger might laugh at the lines he'd written. My father had many friends, most of them writers, and they chose our apartment as their clubhouse because of my mother's cooking and my father's unwillingness to throw anyone out. My mother complained that she was running the Hotel Literati. The place stank of cigarette smoke, and the butts were everywhere, in the potted plants and half-drunk glasses of tea. One night an experimental playwright stuck dozens of butts into gobs of melted candle wax on the kitchen table, representing Roman and Carthaginian forces, so he could demonstrate Hannibal's double envelopment maneuver at the Battle of Cannae. My mother griped about the noise, the broken glasses, the rugs stained with cheap Ukrainian wine, but I knew she liked hosting the crowds of poets and novelists, loved it when they devoured her stews and raved about her cakes. When she was young, she was a pretty woman, and if she wasn't a flirt herself, she liked it when good-looking men flirted with her. She would sit beside my father on the sofa and listen to the debates and rants and decrials, saying nothing but hearing everything, saving it all for the debriefing she would have with my father when the last drunk finally staggered out the door. She was not a writer herself, but she was a very good reader, passionate and eclectic in her tastes, and my father had great faith in her judgments. When one of the great men came to the apartment, a Mandelstam or a Chukovsky, she didn't treat them with any special favors, but I could tell she watched them more carefully, evaluating how they behaved with my father. In her mind, the literary community was ranked as precisely as the army. The ranks might not have titles and insignia, but they were ranks all the same, and she wanted to know where my father stood. Sometimes, when enough bottles of wine had been drained, a poet would stand, swaying slightly as if a strong wind were blowing, and recite a new poem he had written. As an 8-year-old peering into the living room from the hallway, knowing I'd be caught soon and hoping it would be my father to catch me, he was almost impossible to anger, while my mother was quick with a hard hand to the backside. The poems meant nothing to me. Most of the poets wanted to be Mayakovsky, and while they couldn't match his talent, they could mimic his opacity, shouting out verses that made no sense to me at 8, and probably made just as little sense to everyone else in the room. But even if the poems didn't impress me, the performances did. These huge men with their shaggy eyebrows, always holding cigarettes between their fingers, the long stems of ash breaking and drifting toward the floor whenever they gestured too wildly. On rare occasions, a woman would rise and face the staring eyes. Once even Akhmatova herself, according to my mother, though I don't remember seeing her. Sometimes the poets read from scribbled notes, sometimes they spoke from memory. When they were finished, too conscious of all the faces watching them, they reached for the nearest glass of wine or vodka, not only for the drink support, but to give themselves something to do, a simple action to occupy the hands and eyes while waiting for the crowd's reaction. This was an audience of fellow professionals, competitors, and the usual response was modest approval, signaled by nodding heads, smiles, slaps on the back. Once or twice I saw these jaundiced men of letters erupt with euphoria, so moved by the power of the work that they forgot their jealousy as they shouted out, "Bravo! Bravo!" and charged at the dazed, happy poet, kissing his cheeks with sloppy, wet lips, mussing his hair, repeating their favorite lines, and shaking their heads with admiration. Far more common, though, was the reaction of disdainful silence, nobody willing to meet the poet's eye, to feign interest in the subject matter, or half-heartedly compliment the use of a jaunty metaphor. When a reading failed, the poet knew it quickly. He would down his glass of alcohol, the red flush of shame spreading across his face as he wiped his mouth dry with his sleeve and shuffled off to the far side of the apartment, taking great interest in the books on my father's bookshelves, Balzac and Stendhal, Yeats and Baudelaire. The defeated man would leave the party soon, but leaving too quickly would seem like bad sportsmanship, a sulking form of cowardice, so he would wait an agonizing 20 minutes while everyone around him studiously avoided mentioning his poem, as if it were a brutal fart that no one was rude enough to acknowledge. Finally, he would thank my mother for her food and hospitality, smiling but not looking her in the eye, and hustle out the door, knowing that the minute he left, everyone would joke about the atrocity he'd unveiled. What a horror, what a lumpy sack of pretension and artifice. Kolya protected himself by inventing Ushakovo. The make-believe writer gave cover so that Kolya could test his opening line, his protagonist's philosophy, even the title of the book, gauging my reaction without fear of derision. As scams go, it wasn't the most elaborate one, but he had pulled it off nicely, and I decided that Kolya could probably write a decent novel someday if he survived the war and ditched the bombastic first sentence. The talk with Kolya and the encounter with Vika had jolted me awake again, and I peered around the forest, hoping the men in front of me and behind me had better eyes for the darkness than I did. The moon had drifted below the tree line. The sun would not rise for hours. The night was truly black now. Twice I nearly walked into trees. The stars were out in their millions, but they were only for decoration, and I wondered why those distant suns appeared as pinpricks of light. If the astronomers were right, and the universe is clogged with stars, many of them far larger than our sun, and if light traveled forever, without slowing or fading, why didn't the sky shine every minute of the day? The answer must have been obvious, but I couldn't figure it out. For 30 minutes I didn't worry about the Einsatzkommandos and their leader, Abendroth. I forgot about the muscles cramping in my legs. I didn't notice the cold. Were stars like flashlights, unable to project past a certain distance? From the rooftop of the Kirov, I could spot a soldier's glowing flashlight from a few kilometers away, even though the beam could not illuminate my face from that distance. But then again, why did a flashlight's beam lose power over distance? Did the light particles spread out, like pellets in a shotgun blast? Was light even made of particles? My semi-lucid wonderings finally ended when I collided with Kolya's back, banging my nose and crying out in surprise. A dozen voices shushed me. Squinting at the dim shapes in front of me, I saw that everyone had gathered beside a massive, snow-crusted boulder. Vika was already on top of the rock. I don't know how she managed to clamber up its slick, frozen sides in the dark. "They're burning the villages," she called down to Korsakov. The moment she spoke the words, I smelled smoke in the air. "They found the bodies," said Korsakov. The Germans had made their philosophy of retribution very clear to the civilians in occupied territory. They nailed posters to the walls. They issued proclamations in their Russian-language radio broadcasts. They spread the word through their collaborators. "Kill one of our soldiers and we'll kill 30 Russians." Tracking down partisans was difficult work, but rounding up large numbers of old men, women, and children was easy, even now with half the nation on the run. If Korsakov and his men were bothered by the knowledge that their raid earlier in the night had triggered a slaughter of innocents, I heard no indication in their whispered exchanges. The enemy had declared total war when they invaded our country. They had vowed, repeatedly and in print, to incinerate our cities and enslave the populace. We could not fight them in moderation. We could not fight total war with half war. The partisans would continue picking off Nazis. The Nazis would continue massacring non-combatants, and eventually the fascists would learn that they could not win the war even if they killed 30 civilians for every one of their dead soldiers. The arithmetic was brutal, but brutal arithmetic always worked in Russia's favor. Vika scrambled down from the boulder. Korsakov walked over to confer with her. As he passed us, he muttered to Kolya, "So much for Novoye Kushkino." "We're not going?" "Why would we? The whole point was to get there before sunrise and hunt for Einsatz. You smell that smoke? The Einsatz are hunting us." Chapter 18. The partisans kept a safe house a few kilometers inland from Lake Ladoga, a long deserted trapper's cabin on a hillside dense with fir trees. We finally got there an hour before dawn, the sky shifting patiently from black to gray, a light snow falling as the air brightened. Everyone seemed to think the snow was a good omen, covering our tracks and signaling a warmer day. On the way to the cabin, we had walked along a ridgeline overlooking another burning village. The fire was silent, the little houses collapsing into the flames without complaint, flocks of sparks rising to the sky. At a distance, it seemed beautiful, and I thought it was strange that powerful violence is often so pleasing to the eye, like tracer bullets at night. As we passed the village, we heard a burst of gunfire. No more than a kilometer away, 7 or 8 machine guns firing in concert. We all knew what the shot signified, and we all kept walking. The trapper's cabin looked like it had been hammered together from old planks and rusted nails by a man with little skill for carpentry and no patience for the job. The door hung crooked on its hinges. There were no windows, just a pipe jutting out of the rooftop to vent smoke, and no floor but hard-packed dirt. Inside, the smell of human shit was almost too much to stand. The walls were gouged, as if by claws, and I wondered if the ghosts of all the skinned martens and foxes still haunted the place, eager to flay their guests alive when the candles burned out. As cold as it was outside, inside offered no respite from the wind and no added warmth. Korsakov elected one unlucky man to take the first guard shift. The partisan in the Finnish ski patrol uniform removed his pack and set up a little bourgeois stove, filling it with scraps of wood that they had left in the cabin earlier. When the stove was lit, all of us crowded as close together as we could, 13 men and a woman, or 12 men and a woman and a boy, if we were being honest about it. I wondered for the 100th time that night what she would look like with the filthy coveralls stripped off, her pale, dirty skin stretched taut over the blue tracery of her veins. Did she have breasts, or was she flat-chested as a boy? Her hips were as narrow as mine. I was fairly sure of that. But even with her cropped hair and mud-stained neck, there was something undeniably feminine about that proud, jutting lower lip. Did the other men in the group lust for her, too? Or did they all see her as Korsakov saw her, as a sexless sniper with an uncanny eye? Were they idiots, or was I? The shit stench made my eyes water, but soon smoke from the stove camouflaged the worst of the smell, and the fire and our body heat made the cabin comfortable enough. At that point, I could have slept anywhere, and with my father's navy coat laid flat beneath me, and my folded scarf as a pillow, for once I slipped into unconsciousness within seconds of resting my head. A moment later, Kolya nudged me.
"Hey," he whispered. "Hey, are you awake?"
I kept my eyes clutched shut, hoping he would leave me alone.
"Are you mad at me?"
he asked. His mouth was next to my ear, allowing him to whisper directly into my skull without bothering any of the others. I wanted to punch him to make him shut up, but I did not want him to punch me back. "No," I said. "Go to sleep."
"I'm sorry I lied to you. Even if I thought we were dead, it doesn't matter. It was wrong of me."
"Thank you," I told him, and shifted onto my side, hoping he would get the hint.
"You like the title, though? The Courtyard Hound? Do you know what it means?" "Please, please let me sleep." "I'm sorry, sleep, of course."
30 seconds passed in silence, but I could not relax because I knew he was fully awake, staring at the ceiling, waiting to ask me another question.
"You want to know the truth, don't you? About why I left my battalion. You can tell me tomorrow. I hadn't been with a girl in 4 months. My balls were ringing like a couple of church bells. You think I'm joking? I'm not like you. I don't have your discipline. I fucked my first girl 3 days after the first time I came, 12 years old. Didn't have a hair on my sack, but I stuck it in Klava Stepanovich, down in the boiler room. Boing, boing, boing.
Boing, boing, boing?
I get this hunger, I'm telling you. I go a week without it, and I can't concentrate. My brain doesn't work. I'm walking around the trenches with a hard-on out to here."
Kolya's hot breath was on my ear, and I tried to turn farther away, but we were all squeezed together on the earth floor, like cigarettes in a pack.
"We had a party planned for New Year's Eve, the whole battalion. There was vodka. There was going to be some singing. I heard a rumor someone found a few pigs stashed away in a barn somewhere, and we were going to roast them. All-night affair, right? So I figured this is good. Let them celebrate with their vodka and their pigs. I've got other business. We were less than an hour from Peter, by car. I had a friend delivering messages to headquarters. He was going to be in the city for 3-4 hours. Perfect. So I ride with him. He drops me off at a friend's building."
"Sonia?"
"No, a girl named Yulia. Not the most beautiful girl in the world, not even pretty, really. But listen, Lev, this girl made me hard when she filed her nails.
Her pussy was magic. It really was. She lived on the 6th floor, and the whole way up I'm getting myself ready. Already decided the position. Just toss her over the back of the sofa, ass in the air, go in deep. I don't know if you got much going on downstairs, by the way, but if you don't, that's a good position for you. Get you all the way in. Anyway, I finally get to the apartment. I'm starting to unbuckle my belt. I bang on the door. An old woman opens up. Barely bigger than a midget, this woman. Looks about 200 years old. I tell her I'm a friend of Yulia's, and she says, God forgive me, Yulia's been dead a month now. God forgive me. Fuck. So, I say my sorries to this crone, give her a piece of bread because she's barely able to stand up, and run downstairs. Time's running out. There's another girl who lives close by, one of the ballerinas I told you about. A little bit of an ice queen, but the best legs in Peter. I have to climb over a gate to get into her building, nearly get an iron spike up my asshole. But I make it, get to her apartment door, bang on it. It's me, Nikolai Alexandrovich. Let me in. Doors open. Her fat, rat-eyed husband staring down at me. Vile turds never home except this time. Party man, of course. Usually down at the offices, figuring out new regulations for the army. But tonight he decides to stay home and torture his wife for New Year's. Who are you? What is this? He says to me indignant, as if I've somehow insulted him by banging on his door and demanding his wife's wet twat on a plate. I wanted to knock him on his dimpled ass, but that would have been the end of me. So I give him a salute, the civilian cunt, tell him I knocked on the wrong door and disappear. Now I'm fucked. The only other girl I know on that side of town is Rosa, but she's a professional and I've got no money on me. But I'm a good customer. Maybe she trusts me. Maybe she'll take whatever food I've got left in exchange, right? It's a couple of kilometers away. I'm sprinting now, sweating. First sweat since October. There's not much time left before my friend's driving back. I make it there, out of breath, up 4 flights to Rose's apartment. Doors unlocked. I let myself in. And there's 3 soldiers waiting in her kitchen, passing around a bottle of vodka. I can hear her groaning away in the other room, and these drunk morons are singing peasant songs and slapping each other on the back. Don't worry, says one of the last ones in line. I'll be quick. I offered them money to cut the line, except I didn't have any money, and they weren't such morons they were going to take a note from me. I told them I had to get back to the battalion, and one of them said, it's New Year's Eve. They're all drunk. Long as you get back by morning, you'll be fine. That sounded right to me. And they kept passing the bottle around, so I drank with them, and pretty soon I was singing their fucking peasant songs louder than all of them. And an hour later, I finally got to lie down with Rosa. She's a sweet girl. I don't care what anybody says about whores. She let me in for the rest of the bread I had in my pocket, and it wasn't a lot. But she said her pussy was hurting, so she sucked me off instead. 15 minutes later, I'm ready again. She grins and says, oh, I love you young ones, and lets me go inside of her. Very slow, very gentle. And then again, half an hour later, I must have sprayed a litter of cum inside her, north and south.
I had the uncomfortable feeling that Kolya was making himself aroused all over again as he told the story. So you missed your ride back?
Oh, I missed it by hours. But I wasn't worried. I'd find another car heading back to the battalion. I knew most of those boys delivering messages. It wouldn't be a tough trick. You should have seen me walking out of Rose's building. Different human being from the one who walked in. Relaxed, big smile on my face, bit of a bounce in my stride. I step out the front door. I'm practically skipping down the sidewalk, and an NKVD patrol, 4 of the dirty bitches, stops me. Man asks to see my LOA papers. I don't have any LOA papers, I tell him. I'm delivering messages for General Stelmach. The man's planning a battle. He needs rifles. He needs mortars. He doesn't have time to sign some shit-stained LOA. Stelmach's one of your tribe, I think. Did you know that?
Does this story ever end, or are you going to keep talking for the rest of my life?
This little glorified policeman interrogating me? He's got a Hitler mustache. You'd think everyone in Russia with a Hitler mustache would have shaved it by now. But no, this dank cunt thinks it's a good look for him. He asks me why I'm delivering messages from General Stelmach to an apartment building in the Viborg section. I decide a little bit of truth never hurt, decide to appeal to the man's humanity. I give him a wink, tell him I got myself a bit of ass while I waited for my ride back to the General's HQ. You'd think he'd grin and slap my back and tell me to get my LOA in order next time I left my battalion. 4 months I'd been on the front line while this mustachioed dwarf minced around Peter, arresting soldiers for bringing a bit of meat home to their parents, a bag of rice. This was my mistake. I appealed to a bureaucrat's humanity. He has his men slap the manacles around my wrist, and then he gives me this little superior smile and tells me, General Stelmach is in Tikvin, 200 kilometers away, and he's just won an important battle.
You shouldn't have said Stelmach. That was stupid of you.
Of course it was stupid. My cock was still wet.
Several of the partisans muttered at Kolya to shut up, and he lowered his voice.
My brain wasn't working right. I couldn't believe this man was accusing me. Do you understand how fast it changes? I was a soldier in good standing in the afternoon, and there I am, 5 hours later, accused of desertion. I thought they'd shoot me right there in the street, but they took me to the crosses instead. And then I met you, my moody little Hebrew.
How did Yulia die?
What? I don't know. I suppose she starved.
We lay quietly for several minutes, listening to the men around us sleep, some of them quiet, some rasping and nasal, some shushing like wind in a chimney. I tried to distinguish Vika's breathing from the others, curious what sound she made in the night, but it was impossible to tell. I had been annoyed with Kolya for keeping me awake with his endless talk, but in the silence I was suddenly lonely. "Are you asleep?" I asked.
"Hmm?"
he muttered groggy, the fast sleeper, his story told, already sailing away into his dreams.
"Why is it dark at night?"
"What?"
"If there are billions of stars, and most of them are just as bright as the sun, and light travels forever, how come it's not bright all the time?"
I wasn't really expecting an answer. I figured he would snort and tell me to go to sleep, or give some pat reply like, "It's dark at night because the sun is down." Instead, he sat up and stared down at me. I could see the frown on his face by the fluttering light of the bourgeois stove.
"That's an excellent question," he said.
He thought about it some more, peering into the darkness outside of the stove's circle of light. Finally, he shook his head, yawned, and lowered himself to the ground again. 10 seconds later, he was asleep, snoring, the whoosh of his inhalations followed by the chuffing of his exhales. I was still awake when the guard outside came in from his shift, woke up his replacement, refilled the stove with some twigs he'd gathered, and laid down in the circle of huddled bodies. For another hour, I listened to the wood knots popping, thinking about Starlight and Vika, until I finally fell asleep and dreamed of the sky raining fat girls. Chapter 19. The partisan on guard duty woke us before noon, crashing in through the cabin door, trying to keep his voice down despite his panic.
"They're coming,"
he said. We were on our feet before he could get his second sentence out, gathering our gear, instantly alert with the news of real danger. We had slept in our boots and were ready to move. Looks like a whole company, with prisoners. Korsakov slipped his rifle strap over his shoulder. Infantry? Didn't see any armor. 30 seconds later, we streamed out the crooked door into the hostile sunshine. The windowless cabin had been dark as a crypt, and I could barely open my eyes in the noontime glare. We followed Korsakov, and the unspoken order was simple. Run. We never had a chance. Even before the last man was out of the cabin, I could hear German voices shouting. I became like an animal, with no thoughts in my head, nothing but fear to drive me. The air had grown warmer, and the snow was heavy and wet, grabbing at my boots, sucking me down. When I was 9, a delegation of famous French communists visited Peter, and the party spruced up the streets. Workmen, with cigarettes dangling from their lips, poured fresh tar onto Voinova Street and leveled it with long-handled trowels, making my street look like a boulevard of melted chocolate. I had been watching all morning with the Antokolsky twins just in front of the Kirov gates. I don't remember anything triggering our collective decision. Without saying a word, without even a glance at one another, we pulled off our shoes, tossed them into the courtyard, and sprinted across the street. We could have burned the soles off our feet, but we didn't care. We left our footprints in the soft road and kept running when we reached the far side, while the workmen cursed and shook their trowels at us, not caring enough to chase us, knowing we could never be caught. My mother needed an hour that night to scrub my feet clean, angrily scouring them with soap and pumice. My father stood by the window, his hands behind his back, suppressing a smile as he looked down at Voinova. Beneath the streetlights, the road was glossy and perfect, save for three pairs of little footprints marring the surface like seagull tracks on the wet sand. Running across drying tar was not like running through the melting snow. I don't know why the memories linger side by side, but they do. Gunshots echoed among the firs. One whistled past, so loud and close, I touched the side of my head to see if I'd been hit. I saw the man in front of me tumble to the ground, and I could tell from the way he fell that he would never stand again. I could not move any faster, and I could not be more afraid. Watching the man go down changed nothing in me. At that moment, I was no longer Lev Abramovich Benyov. I did not have a living mother in Vyazma, or a dead father in some unmarked patch of dirt. I was not descended from black-hatted Torah scholars on my father's side, or petit bourgeois Muscovites on my mother's. If a German had caught me by the collar at that moment, shaken me, and demanded my name in perfect Russian, I could not have answered him, could not have framed a single sentence to plead for mercy. I saw Korsakov turn to fire at our pursuers. Before he could let off a shot, a bullet cleaved his lower jaw from his skull. He blinked his eyes, still alert, though half his face was gone. I ran past him, up a steep ravine and down the other side, where a stream had formed in a narrow gully, the meltwater gurgling as it snaked past tumbled rocks and fallen branches. Following some unarticulated instinct, I veered off my course to follow the stream, running downhill, along the slippery stones, faster now that I was out of the snow. My body waited for the inevitable bullet. The railroad spike hammered between my shoulder blades, slamming me, face first, into the cold water. Despite everything, I was strangely nimble, my feet picking their next step without consulting my brain, my boots splashing in icy water, never stumbling. I didn't know how long I ran or how far, but finally I had to stop. I ducked behind the trunk of an ancient larch, its drooping branches heavy with melting snow, and sat in the shadows trying to breathe. My legs would not stop trembling, even after I pressed my mittened hands down on my thighs to calm them. When my lungs stopped hurting, I peered around the trunk and looked uphill. Three men were coming my way, rifles in hand, jogging at a deliberate rate. None of them wore German uniforms. The closest man wore a ski soldier's winter whites, and I realized it was the partisan I had seen sucking a dead man's wedding ring off his finger. Markov, the others had called him. I loved him at that moment, loved his blunted red face, the deep-set eyes that had seemed murderous the night before. Behind him came Kolya, and I laughed aloud at the sight of him. I had met him on Friday night and didn't even like him until Monday, and now, Tuesday afternoon, seeing him alive made me want to cry with happiness. He had lost his Astrakhan hat during his flight, and his blonde hair hung over his forehead until he pushed it back. He turned to say something to the man beside him, grinning as he spoke, and I knew he thought he was making a very funny joke. The man beside him turned out to be Vika. Unlike Kolya, she had held on to her fur cap. It was pulled down to her eyebrows, and even from a distance, I could see her wolfish blue eyes roving just below the fringe of rabbit fur. Whatever Kolya said did not amuse her. She did not even seem to be listening. She turned every few paces to check for pursuers. My run could not have lasted very long. 20 minutes? 10? But the inside of the trapper's cabin seemed like a memory stolen from a stranger. Real terror, the genuine belief that your life is about to end violently, erases everything but itself from the brain. So even after I saw Kolya and Vika and Markov, even though their three faces seemed to me the most beautiful faces in all of Russia, I wasn't able to call their names or wave my hand. The shadow beneath the sagging arms of the larch tree was my safe place. Nothing evil had happened to me since I got there. The Germans had not found me. I hadn't seen anyone's jawbone blasted off his face, leaving nothing but puzzled eyes over slop from a butcher's shop floor. I could not beckon to Kolya, even though in 4 days he had become my best friend. Maybe I shifted my position slightly, or shivered. I must have made some slight noise because Vika swiveled toward me, the stock of her rifle pressed against her shoulder, the muzzle pointed at my head. Even then, I wasn't able to speak quickly enough to save my life. I could have cried out her name. Any Russian sentence might have helped. But somehow, though I sat in deep shade, obstructed from view by snow-covered branches, Vika recognized my face and stayed her trigger finger. "It's your little friend," she told Kolya. "Maybe he's wounded." Kolya ran over to me, pushing aside the larch branches, seizing the lapels of my greatcoat, and tilting my whole body left and then right, searching for bullet holes. "Are you hurt?" I shook my head. "Come on, then." He lifted me to my feet. "They're not far behind." "It's too late," said Vika. She and Markov had joined us in the cloistered shadows, and she gestured uphill with the barrel of her rifle. Germans in white anoraks had crested the hilltop. Less than 200 meters away, rifles at the ready, advancing cautiously as they scouted the terrain for ambush sites. Only a few soldiers at first, picking their way through the snow, but more and more came bobbing over the rise, until the hillside above swarmed with men who wanted to kill us. Markov pulled a pair of field glasses from a pocket in his coveralls. He watched the advanced scouts descending the hill.
"First Gehberg's Jäger Division," he whispered, offering the field glasses to Vika. "You see the Edelweiss insignia?"
She nodded, waving away the glasses. Between the lines of uniformed soldiers marched a herd of prisoners, their heads down, Red Army men, their uniforms filthy, trudged alongside stunned civilians who wore whatever they had managed to grab when the Germans raided their villages. Some poor souls marched in their shirt sleeves without coats or gloves or hats. They sloshed through the snow, never looking up or saying a word, heading directly for us. "Looks like a whole company coming this way," said Markov, pocketing the field glasses and readying his rifle. "Figures it happens now, when I've got a pocket full of gold." Vika put a hand on Markov's arm. "You're so quick to be a martyr." He glanced at her, the steel sights of his rifle already lined up on the closest Nazi. "Shooting infantry," she said, "that's nothing. We're after Einsatz." He scowled and pushed away her hand, as if she were a crazy woman on the street who had come begging for money.
"We don't get to choose. All I see is mountain rangers. Einsatz Group A travels with the first Gebersjäger. You know that. Abendroth has to be close."
Kolya and I glanced at each other. Last night we had heard the name Abendroth for the first time. The syllables were already edged with dread. I could not expel the mental image of Zoya writhing on the floor beside her severed feet. The man himself I could not picture. The girls had not described him, but I imagined his hands freckled with blood, the nails filed and immaculate, as he rested the saw on the wood floor of the farmhouse. "It's over," said Markov. "No more running." "I never said anything about running. They've got more than 100 prisoners. We mix in with them.
Have you gone soft, you silly cunt? You think you walk out there with your rifle in the air, Fritz will let you surrender?"
"We're not surrendering." She wrapped one gloved hand around a low-hanging branch, pulled herself up, and wedged her rifle into the gap between trunk and branch. Lowering herself to the ground, she slapped the snow from her gloves and motioned to Markov to hide his rifle, too.
"We're going to mix in with the prisoners and wait for the right moment. They've already searched those sheep for weapons. You've got a pistol on you somewhere, don't you? Come on, hurry. Get rid of the rifle. They might search them again."
"They won't." The closest Germans were less than 100 meters away, their hoods cinched tight over their field caps. Markov stared at them, their pink faces easy targets for a skilled marksman.
"They'll kill half those prisoners by nightfall.
So, we'll be in the other half." Kolya smiled and nodded, warming up to the idea. It was the kind of ludicrous scheme he might have devised himself, and it didn't surprise me he was pleased with it.
"It's worth trying,"
he whispered. If we get in with the rest of them, there's still a chance. And if they spot us, all right, we'll have our shootout then. It's a good plan.
It's a horseshit plan, said Markov.